Following are comments on William Shakespeare's Macbeth, Act I. Fair is foul and foul is fair. The weird sisters set the place and time for their first meeting with Macbeth. In Act I, Scene 1, Macbeth introduces three witches, or weird sisters, who will tempt the loyal Scottish warrior Macbeth. Their sense of expectation is palpable. Their concluding chant is, quote-unquote, "Fair is foul, and foul is fair. Hover through the fog and filthy air." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 11 through 12. They pray for a world turned upside down, and in place of groundedness and certainty, a kind of hovering that may derange humanity's perceptual accuracy and moral bearings. As Hecate later says, human life is about ambition, but also about security, the sure thing. Such bait will hook Macbeth and reel him in. In his Lectures on Shakespeare, Coleridge says supernaturalism sets an excited tone to prepare us for Macbeth's killing of Duncan in Act II. That makes sense, but we might add that the witch's insight seems authentic. It isn't only a metaphor for states of mind or tendencies. Evil is a Shakespearean power, and King James I himself took an interest in occult matters, even writing a volume about what he called demonology. Norton Shakespeare editor Stephen Greenblatt reminds us in his introduction to Macbeth that the witches, unlike Macbeth, are never punished, and he refers to the play's, quote-unquote, "remarkable effect of a nebulous infection, a bleeding of the demonic into the secular, and the secular into the demonic." Introduction, page 910. "What bloody man is that? He can report. King Duncan hears a loyal captain's true recounting of Macbeth's unearthly bravery against the rebellious enemy." In Act 1, Scene 2, Macbeth proves himself a hero early on. Malcolm introduces to his father, King Duncan, a worthy captain, a bloody man, quote-unquote, who promptly reports on what the loyal forces have accomplished against the enemy. His words center on Macbeth's bravery against MacDonald, Cawdor, and Norway. Quote unquote, "disdaining fortune with his brandished steel, which smoked with bloody execution, like valor's minion, carved out his passage till he faced the slave." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 17 through 20. Macbeth killed the rebel MacDonald, and with symbolic aplomb fixed his head atop the battlements. The king pronounces sentence of death against the defeated Cawdor in absentia, and plans to give the title to the hero Macbeth. This supernatural soliciting cannot be ill, cannot be good. To Macbeth's astonishment, the witches hail him as Thane of Cawdor and Scotland's future king. In Act 1, Scene 3, we find that the witches don't hold deterministic power. They claim to know things, but they don't claim they can change events. Of a sailor, one says, quote-unquote, "though his bark cannot be lost, yet it shall be tempest-tossed." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 23 through 24. She can't sink his ship, but she can, through her dark spells and tokens, ensure that he will not have a pleasant trip, to say the least. The witches do not, then, determine a person's fate. They can suggest thoughts and actions, lead people on, and generate or take advantage of circumstances. But no more than that. Macbeth seems hypnotized, but hypnotism only works when people want to do things. The witches provide a vision, but they can't diminish free will. It may be worth noting here that, as Wiktionary.com points out, in Shakespeare's English, the term weird didn't bear the meaning strange or odd. Rather, it implied the ability to control fate, and only came to connote strangeness as a result of the playwright's way of representing the weird sisters. Of course, this explanation implies that to Shakespeare himself, the word weird already suggests something of the sort, as does the witch's collective use of the appellation, quote-unquote, "wayward sisters," in Act 1, Scene 3 of Macbeth, in its 1623 folio edition. Wayward in that phrase was spelled W-E-Y-W-A-R-D. We should acknowledge all this because, as mentioned above, the sisters really do not control Macbeth's fate or destiny, at least not in any simple way. Shakespeare's favorite chronicle source, Raphael Holinshed's Chronicles of England, Scotland, and Ireland, introduces the witches as, quote-unquote, three women in strange and wild apparel, resembling creatures of elder world. The source is Roman numeral 3, Macbeth, page 23, in Boswell Stone's Shakespeare's Holinshed, The Chronicle and the Historical Plays Compared, New York, Longmans, 1896. Holinshed, by the way, describes what was thought about the weird sisters as follows, quote-unquote, "But afterwards the common opinion was that these women were either the weird sisters, that is, as ye would say, the goddesses of destiny, or else some nymphs or fairies, endued by the knowledge of prophecy by their necromantical science, because everything came to pass as they had spoken." Boswell Stone, Macbeth, Roman numeral 3, page 24. When the witches hail Macbeth in succession as Thane of Glamis, Thane of Cawdor, and King Hereafter, Banquo notes the astonishment that registers on his colleague's face. Quote unquote, "Good sir, why do you start and seem to fear things that do sound so fair?" Act 1, Scene 3, lines 49 through 53. Has Macbeth had some such thoughts before, so that he is now stunned to hear them spoken during this strange encounter? Well, perhaps what the witches know is Macbeth's character. They know that for all his sincere and transparent loyalty, his ambition ultimately outweighs his conscience. Macbeth himself probably does not know that, at least not yet. Banquo takes a different attitude towards the witches, saying that he will neither, quote-unquote, "beg nor fear your favors nor your hate." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 61 through 62. Still, if Banquo doesn't care about the future, why ask about it, as he does? Macbeth's mind turns to the provenance of this strange information, from whence, he demands, does it come? And just like that, the weird sisters vanish. Banquo is suspicious and says, quote unquote, "Oftentimes, to win us to our harm, the instruments of darkness tell us truths, win us with honest trifles to betray us in deepest consequence." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 125 through 128. Banquo's medieval Christian mind puts moral considerations first, while Macbeth seems more open to the suggestion of advancement beyond where the feudal order has until now placed him. Macbeth's reflection on his experience is, quote unquote, "This supernatural soliciting cannot be ill, cannot be good." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 132 through 133. Thus, the witches' suggestions or declarations set up a moral antinomy. How can their predictions be both good and ill? Ordinary, tried and true logic forbids such dubious and menacing both-and propositions. So the witch's prophecies unsettle Macbeth, even though his violent thoughts be, quote-unquote, "yet, ellipsis, but fantastical or imaginary." Act 1, Scene 3, line 141. How can even having such thoughts be good? Still, how can being Cawdor and then king be bad? This experience, says Macbeth to himself, quote-unquote, "shakes so my single state of man that function is smothered in surmise, and nothing is but what is not." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 142 through 144. As the Norton Shakespeare editor's footnote number 1 for page 922 suggests, here Macbeth's integrity splits. He is an honorable man and a likely traitor. Murderous thoughts coexist with the fuzzy notion that, quote-unquote, chance may crown me. Act 1, Scene 3, line 146. That is a step on which I must fall down, or else, or leap. When Duncan makes Malcolm his heir, Macbeth realizes he'll need to take the crown by force or fraud if he would be king. In Act 1, Scene 4, King Duncan is shocked by Cawdor's treachery, saying, quote unquote, "There's no art to find the mind's construction in the face. He was a gentleman on whom I built an absolute trust." Act 1, Scene 4, lines 11 through 14. Duncan doesn't fully understand the Machiavellian dictum that people are seldom as they appear. He is a good king, but entirely a creature of the feudal system that has set him on the throne. That system depends for its stability on the loyalty of one's retainers, one's followers, just as Cawdor managed to trick the good old king into failing to perceive his disloyalty. So too will Macbeth and his wife find it all too easy to deprive him of life and crown. The king makes Malcolm Prince of Cumberland, and therefore his heir, which galls Macbeth, who thought the crown might come to him peacefully. Malcolm's preeminence, Macbeth realizes to himself, is, quote unquote, "a step on which I must fall down, or else or leap, for in my way it lies." Act 1, Scene 4, lines 48 through 50. It reinforces the division that the witch's talk has already made within him. He says, quote unquote, "Stars, hide your fires. Let not light see my black and deep desires." Act 1, Scene 4, lines 50 through 51. "Unsex me here and fill me from the crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty." Lady Macbeth reads Macbeth's letter and prays for the strength she needs to make her husband do his part. In Act 1, Scene 5, Lady Macbeth reads her husband's letter. More even than the witches, she understands his latent ambition, and what's more, she knows the fissures in his character. He would accept ill-got gains, but not get them by dishonorable actions of his own. Macbeth is a walking contradiction, a man who is, quote-unquote, "too full of the milk of human kindness to catch the nearest way." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 15 through 16. What Lady Macbeth is saying, then, is that her husband, this fierce warrior admired by all, is soft. Lady Macbeth herself, however, is confident of success. Like a succubus, she will work intimately within him and create the necessary transformation. She envisions her husband coming towards her, ready to receive what she knows she must offer. Quote unquote, "Hie thee hither, that I may pour my spirits in thine ear, and chastise with the valor of my tongue all that impedes thee from the golden round." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 23 through 26. She will make sure Macbeth is man enough to take what, quote unquote, "fate and metaphysical aid have told him is his and hers." Act 1, Scene 5, line 27. Lady Macbeth may already be quite familiar with the same infernal powers who command the Weird Sisters, for she calls upon them to strip her of all feminine softness, saying, quote unquote, "Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here, and fill me from the crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 38 through 41. Macbeth's, quote unquote, "partner of greatness" prays to be transformed into a fierce, steely warrior. Act 1, Scene 5, lines 9 through 10, and lines 36 through 52. Still, her role is that of the cunning woman, the plotter, and seducer. Lady Macbeth cannot have turned overnight into such a devotee of deception and ruthless action. This is who she already is. All that was lacking was the right opportunity to be that person and now, she thinks, it has come. Going forward, Lady Macbeth's prospects for a felicitous ending are not good. As in classical tragedy, for example, the Oresteia of Aeschylus, when a woman arrogates to herself the attributes of a male hero, she must be destroyed. As the play proceeds, Lady Macbeth will lose her unsexed qualities. But at present, Act 1, Scene 5 ends with her taking charge. When Macbeth arrives, she gives him sage but chilling advice. Quote unquote, "Look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent under it." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 63 through 64. "Fair and noble hostess, we are your guest tonight. Duncan and Banquo admire the environment surrounding Inverness Castle, and Lady Macbeth welcomes the king as her sacred charge." In Act 1, Scene 6, King Duncan arrives at Macbeth's castle, praising it as, quote-unquote, "a pleasant seat." Act 1, Scene 6, Line 1. Banquo adds that, quote-unquote, "the air is delicate." Act 1, Scene 6, Line 10. For the moment, Macbeth is the man in the high castle. That's a reference to Philip K. Dick's sci-fi story, which some years ago was turned into a television series. Duncan and Lady Macbeth exchange decorous greetings, and he is conducted to the castle. She is playing the role of innocent flower, as she had recommended to her husband. "I have no spur to prick the sides of my intent." Macbeth is beset by doubts about the murder he is preparing to commit, but Lady Macbeth soon brings him round. In Act 1, Scene 7, ruminating on the deed to come, Macbeth recognizes his dilemma and expresses his desire for an easy kill, one without complications in the aftermath, including the need to remember what has been done. As he wishes inwardly, quote-unquote, "if the assassination could trammel up the consequence and catch with his surcease, success, that but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all." Act 1, Scene 7, lines 2 through 5. If only killing Duncan could be like catching a prized fish in a net without dredging up other unwanted things. But Shakespeare knows that when ambition drives a person to wicked acts, those acts themselves, along with the persisting ambition, will lead to more and possibly even worse crimes to protect what's been won. Throughout this conversation with conscience, Macbeth admits that evil is self-destructive. That's a point we can find, among other places, in St. Augustine's Enchiridion, Chapter 4, The Problem of Evil. Moreover, whoever commits an evil deed becomes its slave. As Lavache says in Act 1, Scene 3 of All's Well That Ends Well, quote-unquote, "he must needs go that the devil drives." As is well known, the saying is much, much older than Shakespeare, or Marlowe before him, since a variation on the adage appears in his celebrated tragedy, Dr. Faustus. Macbeth now sounds less like the sensitive hero we like to imagine than a stage villain 2.0. He freely admits to being in the wrong. He still doesn't feel certain that he should act, and his thoughts tend away from action. Duncan is his feudal lord, his guest, and a good man. His murder would, says Macbeth, generate great pity. Quote unquote, "his virtues will plead like angels, trumpet-tongued, against the deep damnation of his taking off." Act 1, Scene 7, lines 18 through 20. Macbeth again shows us that he knows the wickedness of self-destructive ambition. As he says, quote unquote, "we but teach bloody instructions which, being taught, return to plague the inventor." Act 1, Scene 7, lines 8 through 10. A little after that, he makes a startling confession. Quote unquote, "I have no spur to prick the sides of my intent, but only vaulting ambition." Act 1, Scene 7, lines 25 through 27. As the poet Robert Bridges asks in a 1933 volume by E.E. Stahl, spelled S-T-O-L-L, titled Art and Artifice in Shakespeare, how could someone so capable of being horrified by a prospective crime actually commit it? In his introduction to Macbeth, editor Stephen Greenblatt points out that Macbeth may be Shakespeare's most self-aware villain. See page 906. How unlike Richard III, whom we can hardly imagine doing other than what he does. Macbeth, says Greenblatt, has the capacity to do good or ill. His choice is sincerely meditated and deeply felt. Still, Lady Macbeth brings her husband round to his warrior code. Masculine honor calls for him to take the crown. She taunts him, quote unquote, "When you durst do it, then you were a man." Act 1, Scene 7, line 49. Though Lady Macbeth has had a child and suckled it, she tells Macbeth, quote unquote, "I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out, had I so sworn as you have done to this." Act 1, Scene 7, lines 56 through 59. It is hard to imagine a more misguided or pitiless conception of what it means to be a man. Still, Macbeth is brought round, and soon he and his wife get down to the brass tacks of planning. The conflict between Christian sentiment and pagan heroism that we find in Hamlet also obtains in Macbeth. Macbeth's bloody ambition can only be satisfied by violating Christian principle. Competing codes mean that he must make a moral choice. He has made division within himself and must manage the yawning divide between what is and what seems to be. As he says, quote unquote, "Away and mock the time with fairest show. False face must hide what the false heart doth know." Act 1, Scene 7, lines 81 through 82. By now, Macbeth has made Lady Macbeth's earlier advice his own. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Thursday, June 26th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.